I'm forever glowing bubbles, pretty bubbles in the air.
Hey, it's Beth here, episode 533. It's a news hound because of this guy named Brandon Blackwell. This should be a movie. He's a young man from Queens, 5'6", black guy, good looking. Okay, so he conquered the university challenge in England. This is like Jeopardy on steroids. Snobby show. Most of the schools are Cambridge, and it's a contest where 8 of the 20 quizzers of the planet live on for eternity because they won this show. You make a career out of winning on this show. He couldn't get on. There was no way. He tried to get into a big school in England, couldn't do it. Finally goes to this school called, sounds good, Imperial College. It wasn't. They never won, never got considered. He goes on the show and he's got this theory that instead of picking the smartest people in all the categories, you pick of the four somebody who is fantastic at literature and geography, then someone else who's fantastic at opera and science. He made a formula out of it. He made it work at this school. He won. It was like nobody could believe it. He has facial expressions. They were trying to make fun of him because he is an American. And what happened was there is this thing that I loved it. He was fidgety and eager, a living retort to the Oxbridge ethos of effortless superiority. That is what the Brits do. And it makes everybody just fall down and worship at their feet because it looks like disdain. He didn't care. He never changed. He won. He created a brand new way of playing this game. Everybody does it now. He changed the entire thing. This show has been on for 50 years. He comes in. He changed the way everyone does it from here on out. They call it the Blackwell. All of that effortless superiority fell away. They thought he was gauche, a bit gauche. That's what everybody said. Now everybody wants to be him. He comes back. He sees the winners. His school, the Imperial College, is way ahead of all of these Cambridge, Oxford schools. What he brought to the campus made other kids want to go there and be the winner on this show. And he's the only one with any personality. He nailed it. What he came up with at the tryouts, the deep knowledge of every single category. So now when people want to be on this show, they become deeply entrenched in a couple or three or four things. And there isn't, and then the other thing is, this is the greatest part. He also came up with the person who is entrenched in that category. You have 15 seconds to come up with the answer, is not allowed to speak first. The other person who thinks they know has to come up with the answer. And 5% of the time, that's the answer. So he was winning, but he wasn't winning at this rate that blew everyone out of the water till he realized that that other person, if they think they know, they might. And even if they don't, sometimes the guy changes his answer listening to what that person has to say. This guy is the greatest. Brandon all the way. Changed everything. How come I never heard of this? How come I never hear about anything? Okay, now also there is a new Woody Allen movie coming out. Okay, everybody has a feeling about him. It's called Coup de Chance, and it means stroke of luck. It looks like a really good murder premise. This young, beautiful girl gets married to this older guy and reacquaints herself with her friend, who is this gorgeous guy, when she was younger. And they say it's a really tight script and a really great story and the best thing he's done in years. So, coup de chance, you're going to hear about it. Then there's this play, Brian Frail's play. He's an Irish guy. It's called Philadelphia, Here I Come, Irish Repertory Theater. I wish they would just make movies out of these plays so I could see them. I can't get to the Irish Repertory Theater. Charles Isherwood is really, really, he's the Wall Street Journal critic, and he's really rough. He raves about it. I just wish they would put it, I would see it in the movie theater. Just film it, put it in the movie theater, and let me see it. Why can't they do that? You know, I mean, and charge me twice as much. I will pay it. I want to see the actors who did it. I don't want to see the movie actors. I don't want to see Michelle Pfeiffer take over a role of a guy who's 32 years old because she's a big star or something. I want to see the people that were in the Broadway play. Okay, there I got. That's my pet peeve. Okay, now there's a single hair of a, this is a, in Java, there is a Java tiger that hasn't been seen since 1976. This guy who works at a convenience store told his friends that he saw the Java tiger, okay? It gets to one guy at a university who believes him. Nobody believes him. They go to where he saw the tiger, where he said he saw it, the Java tiger. There was one hair that was left on the fence. He takes it. He analyzes it. It's the Java tiger, and people still don't believe it. What I love is that a scientist actually listened to somebody at a convenience store. So that was good. Now, there was a subway killing. It's very sad. But the story of this little girl. So Jason Valls had this daughter named Jana, and they were just, he was a homeless guy and he was an addict, and he was just reacquainting himself with his daughter after years of nothing. And she opened up her heart, and she wasn't mad at him anymore, although he never came to anything, and he never helped her poor mother support her, who had like three jobs. Okay, this girl is lovely. The sad thing is, she says, I never held resentment, and I'm grateful that I never did because I got to feel his true love. The bad thing is, they were getting ready to meet in person, and they had a father-daughter spat on the phone. And she said neither one of them wanted to admit they were wrong, so she never made it over to his house. And he didn't want to meet her until he had a house and a job. And he got to that point, and he had a little apartment that he was renting, fixed it up, wanted to see Jana in his own home. They had this stupid little father-daughter spat on the phone. And she was going to bring this dollhouse over to his house that he gave her. And they were supposed to paint it. And they never got a chance to paint it. So it was going to be this beautiful time where she brings over this dollhouse that has been waiting to be painted for 30 years. And she had it all ready to go. And they had this fight. Neither one of them would admit they were wrong. 2 weeks later, he's pushed onto the tracks and he dies. I'm like, Jana, you do not deserve this. You don't deserve to feel bad. You don't deserve to have any of this pain. Oh my gosh, what are the odds? This poor little kid. I mean, that's what happens. Somebody dies and somebody pays the price forever. I almost cried. Poor little Jana. If I knew her, I would tell her the grace and dignity that she has, that she could open her heart and love this guy and bring over this dollhouse, and some stupid little fight kept it from happening, and now she feels bad forever. I'm just like, oh, please, please, God, don't let that happen. Jenna, get over it. You're a great person. You're a lot better than I would have been. I don't think I would have been so dignified and so loving and so forgiving. She should pat herself on the back, but she's killing herself. Ugh, I hate when things like that happen to good people. I really hate it. In fact, there's a book out there. It's been out there for 30 years. when bad things happen to good people. Of course, of course. And that's what's happening to Jenna. She's a good person. I personally want to write the book when good things happen to bad people. When bad people make all the money. When bad people have incredible wives that love them with all their hearts and go on great vacations on the backs of people that work so hard and don't have anything. When good things happen to bad people would be a bestseller. Somebody needs to write it. Okay, that's another pet peeve. I guess I'm in a bad mood. Okay, this is cute. In the New York Times, they had 90-year-olds. Okay, there is Joan Collins looking pretty good in a hat. Her hand's a little old looking, but so what? And she's talking about her life and how she's unstoppable and how she keeps working and she'll never stop. She has a young boyfriend too. Then there's Martha Stewart, and she is 82 and she's never going to quit working. She learned a lot of lessons from, both of them learned a lot of lessons from their mothers who went through the Depression and World War II. And actually, Joan Collins remembers, because she's 90, being a little girl and being in the underground. And people would sing and talk, and she didn't even know that it was a bad thing until years later it caught up with her. And she had post-traumatic stress syndrome 20 years later, because even though she was acting like a really happy little kid, singing and holding her mother's hand, deep down, she hid away how awful it was. So, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, and she felt that her mother needed her to be strong, which I think kids do all the time. Okay, Giorgio Armani is here. He's 89. He is still the king of his kingdom. And he grew up in the shadow of war, and ambition became something that was a vital drive. It took him some time to find his way. This is the interesting thing. First, he studied medicine. Then he went to an Italian department store where Armani worked in the display. When I worked at Neiman's in Houston, the display guys were geniuses. They would create stories. They would pick the most beautiful clothes. They would make the models evocative. It was... And they were so smart, and they never got the amount of credit that they deserved, ever. So anyway, he was at Armani's, he worshipped him. Every move he made at that department store, every window, every display, and that's how he found his ambition. And it was Armani. And this guy, I mean, it's crazy. That's where he became a display guy. And this guy, Cerruti, that was his fashion label. He learned everything he learned from the guys in display. They were geniuses. They taught him everything he knew. For the first 10 years of his career, he just copied what those guys had taught him. So yeah, I'm not wrong. I thought they were geniuses. The main pressure is staying relevant without giving in to the pressures of the moment, which often feel very urgent, but are forgettable in the long run. I will not give in to the ridiculous things people are wearing now. I will not give in to cheap products, fabrics, and designs. And I'm like, good for you. Because nothing that you see in any of these new vogues in the past 3 years is lasting. None of the designs. They're not timeless. They're not beautiful. Armani's right. 89 years old, and he still has it. Okay, here is a tiny love story in the New York Times, okay? Underneath Modern Love. Okay, so this girl writes, Yessa, my dad's old dog, was missing one leg and all her teeth. Weeks before my son and I visited them in Warsaw, she stopped eating. My dad never let my childhood dog in the house when I was little. Yet his dog, he was making crepes and butter, singing to it, just to keep this dog alive. The father grew up poor in communism. Wasting food was unthinkable. But he wasted all this food with his dog. My grandmother was the cheapest person who ever lived. Nanny. She had saved every bit of silver foil, every rubber band. You had to eat everything on your plate. She found meat at the butcher with big veins in it. She would force you to eat the veins. It was disgusting. But her little poodle Fifi, that was obese, only ate candy and the best pieces of meat. And you'd be sitting there and you'd be watching her loving Fifi and treating you like dirt. I don't know what communism brings out in people, but I don't know where dogs get all the credit for whatever and all the people don't. But the very same thing, Warsaw, Germany, New York City, Germantown, whatever, wherever you went through the Depression, you came out with some crazy idea about your dog babying some obese poodle. God, I mean, she used to almost chew the meat for Fifi. I couldn't stand it. I wanted to be a dog. I wanted to get away. Very same thing. I don't know if other people had it. I don't know if it's just a thing with this person with Yaza and me and Fifi. But watching your grandmother treat a dog with all the love and compassion and generosity in the world when she gives you nothing, I don't get it. She was the first person to re-gift. I received, when I was 5, a recipe box with recipes in it. I mean, what is wrong with you? And then I said I didn't want it. She took it back. And she gave it to my brother. I'm like, wow, you got nothing. You got nothing? And all she wanted was lavish gifts. And if they weren't lavish, she would just throw them on the ground. You had to bring her food. It was like, you know, Alice in Wonderland and the Queen, never satisfied. And her little Fifi, rotten little poodle with the sharpest, meanest teeth. Forget it. Okay, so I'm just going to put a movie on the end of this because I want to. It's called Cabrini, Angel Studios. Christina Dallana is in it. It's a great story. It was never going to come about until the King of Prussia businessman, J. Eustace Wolfington, forked over $50 million to get his favorite saint this movie. Okay, the movie's really good, but it doesn't make sense. They leave out these important details, which are, she never took no for an answer, but she didn't get the orphanage by herself. A baroness from Bavaria gave her all the money and her house on 54th Street to give to the children in the orphanage. That was a big boon. The other one was, she was the first saint in America. And there were four miracles that put her up front in front of God and everybody. One was when she was still trying to get things done in New York City in the Five Points for all of the little poor children. She didn't just go into these meetings with all these men and they folded for her. There was this little boy, he was in the hospital. And really, the hospitals didn't accept Italians very much. But if a woman was pregnant, they would let the woman in and she could have the baby. She would be sent away pretty quickly. They made a mistake with this little boy and they put too much nitrates in his eyes, the mercury, whatever they put in their eyes to clear them. Back in the day, they used to do it. They over-medicated this kid and he became blind. Mother Cabrini heard about it. She goes rushing over to the hospital and she starts praying for this little tiny baby. And the nuns take a little piece of her habit, her outfit, and attach it with a safety pin to the onesie of the baby. And then she continues praying. The doctors are watching. There's an Irish doctor. He's in the movie. This Irish doctor who became friends with her. We didn't know how this friendship began. It's because he saw this miracle. So he's examined the baby's eyes and they are filled with scar tissue from what had happened. Mother Cabrini goes in, she prays for the baby. The very next morning, all the scar tissue is gone and the baby can see. Okay, so when she goes into meetings after that, like with the mayor and the cardinal, she's performed this miracle. And boy, are they listening. I don't know why it wasn't in the movie. It would have been a great extra thing. And then, you know, she had fallen in the water in Italy and her lungs were severely damaged, so she couldn't even get into orders because they wouldn't accept her because she was frail. She finally starts her own order. She does amazing things throughout the world. Everybody thinks she's going to die anytime. Like from the age of 32, they thought she was going to die in a year. Every prognosis was 6 months, 5 months, 2 years, whatever. She gets to 64 and she dies in Chicago of dysentery, which I just think is weird because everybody thought it would be her lungs. Anyway, it's a great movie. I wish it would be shown in schools. It's beautiful. I don't know why they kept all the saint stuff out of it. She's the first American saint. I know a girl who went to the Cabrini, Francis Xavier Cabrini High School in New Orleans, and she didn't even know all the details about the saint. Nobody does. It's a great story. She started something that went worldwide, helping children, saving children, building hospitals that were marvelous, that would take everyone. She went all across the world. She was a force of nature. So it was a great movie, but the miracles are pretty cool too. So anyway, if you can see it, see it. It's still in the theater. It's been there for a while. It's only made $19 million. It costs $50. I don't think Mr. Eustace is very upset, Wolvington, but it is a great movie. If you want to go see something nice after all the junk I've been seeing and all the anti-heroes, to just see a hero, roll up her sleeves and just keep working and working and working for children, it just made me feel, it was like a palate cleanser. I just felt great afterwards. But I didn't understand how she had all this power over these men. And then you find out that they really think she's touched by God. And that her voice is powerful. A little miracle never hurt anybody. So that's what I've got. And it made me sane. And I will be back. Thanks.
They fly so high, nearly reach the sky. Then, like my dreams, they fly.